Who is tired of paying those huge cable subscription bills? What if you could just get the handful of networks you like to watch via YouTube? I'm Jefferson Graham with USA Today. You're listening to Talking Tech. This week, YouTube said it was investing in a future that would see it grow its presence on traditional TV sets. And then word came out that CBS had signed up to be part of the so-called skinny bundle that YouTube is looking to put together next year. YouTube will possibly join Hulu, Sling TV, and others in trying to appeal to cord cutters. What does this mean to YouTube's future? We'll weigh in on today's extended weekend edition of Talking Tech, look at new research that shows just how interested consumers are in virtual reality, and meet yet another new live streaming app. Busker looks to take on Facebook with a twist, e-commerce sales tools. Finally, we'll also chat with a tech investor on the hottest tech trends. Jim Armstrong has the checkbook. What is he looking to fund for the future? Let's start off by meeting our panel. Say hi to Jim.
Hi, I'm Jim Armstrong with March Capital Partners, a venture capitalist based in Los Angeles, California.
And a neighbor of the Talking Tech host. Yes.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Mike?
Hi, I'm Mike Vorhaus, president of Magnet Advisors. I'm a tech media analyst.
Hi, my name is Lippe Oosterhoff. I'm an entrepreneur. I moved here from Europe about a year ago, which explains the funny accent. And I'm co-founder and CEO of Busker.
Let's jump into YouTube. The world's most popular video network is looking to expand beyond its mammoth collection of cat and music videos and original productions from homegrown stars by expanding into traditional TV with a new service reportedly called Unplugged. The service, which is set to debut in 2017, will compete with cable, offering a smaller grouping of channels for like $25 to $40 monthly. My question is, watching network TV relevant to YouTube's mostly young audience? What are the chances they'll actually pay for it? Mike, you want to jump in?
Well, no audience is more likely to cut the cord than the 18 to 24-year-olds, and then you got the 24 to the 35-year-olds. So the traditional TV guys have a decade or so to work their way through some of this, but their business model is falling apart in bits and pieces, that's for sure.
Jim, what do you think?
I think it's another brick in the wall. I think TV's gone from a device to a service to a thing you order. In my day, you order your phone and your cable when you move into a new place, and it's becoming increasingly incrementalized. So you're going to have people who will pay the little bit extra to make sure they have a chance to see everything. And with the rise of binge watching and a lot of the new behaviors, you have people who are willing to pay for bits and pieces. And along with what Mike said, it's going to be a gradual, slow, but consistent, you know, steady drumbeat of change away from your monthly one bill all to a series of subscribers. And this is another important step. The next big important step will be on the sports front, when some of the major sports networks sign with OTT versus cable's done a good job locking those in and paying, or some would say overpaying, to make sure they have some proprietary content.
I'm going to be contrarian here. I don't know of network TV shows that young people watch. I just don't think they're watching television. They may watch some of these shows piecemeal online, but to get them to pay $40 a month, right, Claire, is just, I think, a big hurdle to jump. I just don't see them doing it.
I agree with you. It's not going to be a big hit, but I do believe it'll launch with 50 or 100,000 users who want to do it, and then it'll grow slowly, and it's a shot across. I know in my household, which has millennials, not me, they are hooked on some of the TV shows. They love to see Parks and Rec. They love to see Supergirl. They love to watch reruns of The Office. And so I agree. They are also big fans of a lot of the YouTubers and a lot of the people with the homegrown media content.
Okay, so of those shows you mentioned, they're all on Hulu,
right?
I believe. Right, Claire?
Yes.
Okay. And that's $9.99 a month.
Right.
Versus $40 a month.
So the question is for the CBS content, can they so maybe the audience will be 25 or 30 to 45-year-olds. I know I did a recent survey around a breakfast get together with folks who are more baby boomers, my generation. I'm at the very end of that. And I asked how many had cut the cord, and that was the way the question was asked, and only one had, and he admitted that he had to suffer and not see some of the content he wants. So I agree, it starts 40 does seem steep. I thought there was a $25
off, 25 to $40.
Yeah, with the bow offering. And they're going to, I think it comes down to what is your proprietary content? It's the content that sells, and there's a wide variety of it. But I can't make a strong argument against your counterpoint. But I do think they will get some takers just because of the brands involved.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the whole notion of coupling content and distribution is going away. So it's all about content at the end of the day, right? And in order to reach a younger demographic, you've got to think about the platforms that they use. You know, that's what explains Snapchat. Snapchat is usually successful with bringing content and brands to millennials. Right? Nobody else can touch them the way they do. So I think the price point doesn't make sense to me, to be honest. Yeah. Right? For that demographic, you got to rethink the price point. But at the end of the day, this is an unstoppable trend. So if you're in the cable business and you have a vested interest in content, you got to make up your mind where you want to be. So content is a great business to be in, but you got to experiment and figure out how you distribute it these days, because there's so many platforms to choose from. I think the danger for these guys is going to be a race to the bottom, because there's going to be a price competition. Google is going to get into it. Apple is going to get into it.
Right.
AOL with Yahoo and Verizon, they're going to make a big punch for this. So it's great for the consumer.
What about you talked about the cable companies? What about YouTube? Should they be trying, in your opinion, to lock up proprietary content?
No, they already are. Right, they're making a huge put. The studios are right here. They're making tons of investment in original content because they know that that's where the money is at the end of the day. But it doesn't carry a brand. So this is an interesting experiment to kind of replicate the success that they already have with their own, the influencers that make funny, great YouTube clips with, guys. I've met guys that are bigger than CNN. PewDiePie has more viewers on a daily basis than CNN in the U.S., which is crazy.
There are many, many people more than CNN. Mike, do you have any intelligence on Red? YouTube Red is the subscription service they launched a year ago with original programming from YouTube stars for $9.99 a month, along with the bonus that you get ad-free YouTube, and you get to watch it in the background.
Which, by the way, is the right price point.
Yeah.
$4.99, $9.99, those are the right price points.
Do they have any subscribers to YouTube?
I don't have any. We've done a fair bit of work for them here and there, including a very interesting study where 40% of the people on YouTube said they found the YouTube content as good as regular TV. But I'm not privy to their subscription numbers. I bet it's well under $1 million. I mean, it hasn't been particularly well promoted.
They've never said.
Yeah, not to best of my knowledge, they haven't.
Historically,
and they are part of Google, right. So we know that means they're almost as secretive as Microsoft.
But historically, when you've got good news, you report it.
Yeah, and also with most of these, other than Hulu Plus, obviously Netflix, breaking a million is pretty rare. And I doubt they're even near a million yet.
Where should they be?
Well, I would drop the price to $4.99 and push the ad free. I know that works with consumers. We've done that in any number of environments in terms of consumer research, and it's worked really well in gaming, the ad free environment. So that's what I would do. I think it's hard to get people to spend a lot of money for brand new, completely authentic, original content that's 60 minutes or 120 minutes. It's an old fashioned way of consuming media. There's so many old great reruns that they can watch. There's so many new 10-minute, 5-minute, 2-minute pieces of content coming out.
I can turn on YouTube at any given time and keep myself busy for an hour, 2 hours. There's so much. Which brings us back to network TV. We just talked about what they're doing with Red and what the prices should be. Do you think, or how are they going to convince young people to pay for CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox?
Well, I don't think they're going to convince them forever. I do think they've got quite a few years. This stuff goes very slowly. In any media world, things move relatively slowly. When we forget that YouTube must be, a dozen years old?
Ten years old.
Yeah. They've actually done quite well in 10 years. But, these guys make a lot of money because their ads still work. It's still a way, remarkably, to get 5 million, 10 million people to watch an ad. You run it a number of times and the right time slots. These political candidates are spending a ton of money on TV ads. So TV ads still work. They work a lot better than print ads work. Therefore, people are going to continue to buy them. Therefore, the networks are going to continue to make expensive content. They should probably, and I guess they're all dabbling in this, look a lot more making inexpensive content.
Okay. Well, so Jim's agreeing with me that it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
And but the networks have to do it. I mean, the networks have to do this.
Yeah, they have to. And I think the revenue models in play, which is really interesting to me, ad or subscription. In a lot of markets, you see things move. In a lot of internet companies, apps, things that aren't media and video related, but they move from ad-driven to subscription as you create a better value proposition. And I think I don't watch ads anymore, certainly not on traditional television.
Because, you tape everything?
Yeah, I DVR everything. And then, but I watch them because I have to watch them, and they're creatively done for the right format on YouTube. And so what's that mix going to be? I always love subscription models as an investor because they're pure and you're not subject to the vagaries of the ad market.
And but always forget to cancel.
And there's a lot of that. It's amazing how much of that is out there. But the ad model works on those. So I think the mix will be interesting.
Okay. Let's move out into the streets and play some guitar and sing some songs and ask for a tip. What do you think?
It's a beautiful day in LA.
Okay. Yeah. So Facebook, the world's largest social network, is promoting going live all the time as a way of keeping the news feed fresh, and they're paying celebrities and brands big bucks to be live. We've got Periscope, YouNow, and several other live streaming services looking at that audience. Is there room for yet another live streaming service? We've got someone here who believes that the answer is yes. I can't get it.
What is Lipa.
It? Lipa. Got it. Oosterhoff?
Yes, that's pretty good.
Okay. Lipa Oosterhoff thinks so, and he's going to tell us why right now.
Okay. So, Busker, let me first explain what it is, right? And then we can get into the discussion of why it makes sense to launch yet another live streaming app. So Busker is it's a live streaming app, which means that you can press a button, you can broadcast live, anybody can tune in and watch you, and the audience can interact with the broadcaster, right? So they can type messages on the screen, they can chat, the broadcaster reads that in real time, and they can respond. Okay, so far nothing new if you've heard of apps like Meerkat or Periscope or even Facebook, right? So interactive live broadcasting. Now, when we, as a team, we're a bunch of entrepreneurs, co-founder the founder of Price Grabber, myself with a video background, and we all got together probably 2 years ago. And we looked at it and we said, you know, this is so interesting what's going on here, but there is something missing from what Meerkat is doing and from what Periscope is doing. Because I don't know if you've tried those apps, but if you look at the content, it's not great. Right, most people are not very good at live broadcasting. Right, it takes a talent. It takes really an incredible talent to be live in front of a group of strangers and see messages on the screen and respond to that. So we said, okay, this is an interesting format. It's a new media format that people haven't figured out yet, but we believe it's going to be, you know, taking a chunk of people's time. Right. In addition to consuming photos on Instagram and videos on YouTube, this is life is coming, but nobody has really figured it out yet. So in order to really make it interesting, you got to have people create content that know what they're doing, right? You got to have people that understand the rules of this new medium. So I don't know if you remember Vine.
Yes.
When Vine first came out, remember the 6-second video?
Right.
Everybody said, how dumb is that? I mean, who's going to watch 6-second videos? And then about 6 months later, there was this whole generation of people who said, I can be super creative in 6 seconds. In fact, I can be more creative in 6 seconds than I could ever be on YouTube because this touches my specific talent. And the same is happening now on live. There's people that take this live format, and on YouTube, they couldn't get an audience. But now on live, they suddenly find out how to interact with the audience and how to be funny or entertaining or do things that was never possible before. Now, that's the backstory. When we decided to start this company, we said, if we can find a way to attract that talent, if we can find a way for them to choose us over all the other apps, then we win. And the answer to that is money. Right now, Facebook is throwing a lot of money at big people like The Rock, you know, and the New York Times, and they're kind of thinking in broadcaster mode, and that's probably to attract TV dollars. But we approach it from the other side. We approach it from the little man, not people that you haven't heard of yet. And we said, what if those people can make money, not from us, we're not going to pay them. Occasionally we do, but most of the money comes from the audience, right? So the two models are very straightforward, tipping and buying. So when somebody's live on the air, they can do something, they can, you know, be funny or play a musical instrument, do whatever. And then if the audience is enjoying it, they can tip. Now, that tipping happens within the video. It's completely native to the experience. So while you're live, you press a button, you see a tip flow across the screen. The broadcaster will say, oh, thank you, Jeff. Thank you for that tip. That's amazing. And then he'll continue. So you get an immediate feedback.
And that's exactly what you can do on You Now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what's the other one? There's a music service.
Musical.ly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Musical.ly.
Inky in China did $100 million dollars in revenue 2 months ago with this exact model.
China,
and it's all
huge.
G-rated, right?
Yep. It's all G-rated. So this thing blew up in China. After Meerkat launches, there's a bunch of companies in China that said, we can do this too. Now, the difference with all of those apps, including You Now and us, is that all of those tips are virtual stickers, right? So you buy some credit in the App Store. Apple takes 30%, or Google. And then when the broadcaster receives a few stickers, there's an unknown exchange rate, and then they get paid by at the end of the month. According to the reports, the average creator gets about 30% of what comes in. On Busker, they get 85% of what comes in because it goes straight on your credit card.
And your pitch to somebody is why waste time doing Facebook Live when you could do it here and get a tip?
It's about making money, right? So.
But on this other side of the coin, all my friends are on Facebook, and they're not on Busker.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've seen a big migration of talented folks from Periscope already join Busker because they said, why would I do this for free if I can make some money, right? We have a bunch of people that already make a living on this. We just launched Commerce, which is the main way to make money, right? So it's almost like a mix between, I shouldn't be saying it, but I'll do it anyway, QVC and Periscope, right?
Okay. Now, Jim is writing down a hard question. He just put on his investor hat.
Exactly.
And he's going to give you a hard-hitting question.
Please.
Which is, I'm going to give you two, actually. And the first one is, are you saying that the way you have quality control is because people know they have to make a living there and the economic incentive is what controls quality? Because you started out by saying a lot of the live stuff is not worth watching, but Busker has solved that.
Yeah, absolutely. Meerkat and Periscope invented the genre, right? But most of the content isn't great because the people with real talent, they want to make money and they do it elsewhere, right? So what we've seen is that the ratio of creators to quality creators is super high on our app and on similar apps out there, but...
But you're not managing that. You're not saying you on, you off.
Anybody can go live on our platform, right?
All right.
But the people that get a lot of engagement from the audience, and that could be messages or likes or money or purchases, right? That content bubbles up automatically. So there's a natural selection process of great content that bubbles up on the platform, and the business model itself attracts the right type of creators, right?
And the second question is the broadcast to a large audience and letting them message to the performer has been tried, or let me ask it this way. Have you seen any other mediums, even going back historically, where that's worked and been successful? Because I can't think of any.
No, but that's kind of the point, right? So the internet brought connectivity between people, right? And in that sense, it's fairly new. What we're seeing now is live for the first time now as of 5 years ago, the internet is finally ready to do live at scale, right? Either big events where U2 or the guy that jumped from space, those very big events, that works now.
Yeah.
But also the one to few, which is the space that we're playing in, right? People broadcasting to 50 or 100 people. So it's a fairly new thing. But if you go all the way back to, you know, what is so special about live, right? And we think that it's human connection, right? Think about it.
I agree. Live is its own category for certain types of events, certain types of scenarios. I agree.
Yeah. And in some environments, there's not very good media choices. I mean, in China, yes, you don't have the plethora of media choices that we have here in the West. I'm also told that a lot of people like this approach in China because they're living in the five biggest cities, but they're from the 30, 40, 50 cities of a million people, and they miss those towns.
Yes.
This is a way to stay in touch with their community. Yeah. I mean, it is a new business model outside of pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, tipping has worked in pornography, yeah, based on my limited professional obligation to investigate. So this tipping does exist there. And now it exists for people saying poems, singing songs, cooking,
yeah,
eating.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In China, there's $3 or $4 billion companies that didn't exist a year ago that are big in this genre. But you're totally right, right? In China, it's partly culturally driven. People living in remote villages, but also men that are very reluctant and afraid to approach women, right? And there's no pornography on these platforms. The Chinese government doesn't allow it. In fact, they recently issued a law where girls are not allowed to eat bananas on a live stream. I kid you not.
Right? How do they feel about pineapples?
As strawberries.
Totally different case. Totally different case. As long as there's no whipped cream involved.
Because I missed this news headline. Didn't you? Did you see it?
A friend of mine's invested in it. I couldn't stop hearing about it.
About the banana?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. About the $100 million a month.
Yeah. No, it's huge. It's huge. But now think about why that happens, right? And it goes back to your point. It's interactive.
Yeah.
It combines the power of live video where you have a kind of a suspense and you're part of the moment. But on top of that, you can interact with each other. You know, the broadcaster and the viewers with each other. So you see things like polling and tipping and buying, and all of these things are being innovated as we speak. You know, the amount of innovation of the last 3 or 4 months from those Chinese apps and here in the U.S. is amazing. I was in a panel yesterday with you know, the president of Endemol Shine and a few others. They're all in the content business. And these guys are really trying to scratch the opportunity of what do you do with live content. They know there's an opportunity there. The engagement is enormous when people are experiencing something live. Now you just have to tap into, you know, the money side of things.
Okay,
and
so
we think we have that.
Busker.co.
Yeah.
And you're in the Apple and Android app store?
Yeah, on both.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to virtual reality. Every day there seems to be yet another headline about virtual reality and 360 video and gaming. Today, the NBA said it would present 24 basketball games this season in VR. And USA Today launched its own VR experience called Virtually There. My question, does the consumer care? And if so, why? Mike Vorhaus, an analyst with Frank G. Maggot Associates, has recently studied the market, and he's going to tell us about his findings.
Well, that's right. We did a study back at the very end of July in the United States with a large national population, 8 to 64-year-olds, so pretty much every generation that we could talk about. A quarter of everybody in that sample said that they were very interested in trying VR. Another one-fifth said they were interested. So you've got people, there's clearly, you know, 40-45% of the country that would like to try a VR environment. There's been 40 million of these low-end Google cardboard boxes pushed out by any number of people in the New York Times. You guys probably pushed them out of USA Today and Gannett, the company I'm on the board of, Parion, used them to push out a B2B announcement. People are using these for all sorts of reasons. The big devices, $500, $400, $300, $200 for a mobile Gear VR, these are cost more, so they're going to grow slower, but they're going to sell as many as they can make right now. This is going to be environment of 1 to 2 million units sold over the next 18 months, and that's all these big guys are going to be able to make. Does it become a 30-40 million unit at $300? Well, that would be like a console. That would be very impressive. Depends on how good the content is, right? And there again, there's a wide breadth of G, PG, R, and X-rated content on VR also.
Why do people care?
It feels different. There's something, I have to believe that you've tried it.
Of course.
Everybody that we've talked to, that we've talked to them before they tried it, we have them use a variety of these devices, we talk to them afterwards, they feel it. It's special. You sweat, your heart rate goes up, you get excited.
It's funny, I've never sweated once while watching VR. Have you, Jim?
No, but I have been impressed.
Well, you're both much thinner than me, so I do
more
understand
so
that.
By the systems that are more complicated and set up the linears and the systems where you can have beacons and move within the system.
You're talking about HTC Vive?
Yes, yeah, and less so with the headsets, just the straight headgear, the one that Samsung's pushing a lot and others. I would say it's definitely captured people's attention. In this world where everyone's been amazed over the past 5 years at the pace of innovation in technology and communications, everyone has gravitated that this is the next thing, even though I don't think they know what it is and they haven't experienced it yet. So I take your 25% to mean I want to learn more. I have not yet spoken to anyone who's experienced a sporting event in VR. I have not, but and I don't know how what an improvement that would be or not.
I know that I love going to IMAX movies. I love being immersed in this giant screen. I've never seen a VR experience that came close to IMAX. I don't know about you, Jim. But, you're wearing something on your head. It's a little hard to focus. It feels a little awkward. You know, when it works, great. And you go up and down and left and right, and you see different stuff. My first experience with the Oculus was, wow, this is amazing. I can't imagine having worn it for an hour. Or an hour and a half, you know. Maybe they're going to get to the point where they'll look as good as IMAX. I think they have a long way to go.
Well, they'll be implanted into your eyeballs 15 years from now. They'll be in contact lenses 5 years from now. I mean, this form factor is terrible. Any of them, they're large devices. The high-end devices from Sony and from HTC and from Facebook Oculus are large 10, 20-pound devices. They sit on your head. You have to adjust them constantly. They're not hour-long devices, but lots of good 10 and 15-minute content.
Okay, the youngest guy at this table is Lipa. Hmm. What do you think?
By far.
Thank you, first of all. I think we're the VR headset market is pre-iPhone, right? So something is going to come
pilot.
Along.
It's Palm Pilot.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. It's going to, in the next few years, something is going to come out. It's going to blow us away. I've got an iPhone 7 Plus with the two cameras. Mm-hmm. That's Apple saying, okay, we're preparing ourselves to do something in AR and VR. And we're going to come out with something hardware in the next 3 years that is actually usable. Second, I think AR is way more interesting than VR. You know, this whole closed-off feeling of, you know, bumping into walls with a big thing on your face is not as compelling to me personally as an AR experience where, you know, you can get the best of both. So that to me is exciting.
I went to visit a VR studio yesterday called Riot. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them.
Yes.
They're in Venice on Venice Boulevard in Sentinella. They're right next to a liquor store, and on the side of the wall it says Riot Virtual Reality, which is love, right? And they showed me some AR stuff there that blew me away. So they have a fake Esquire magazine cover with their CEO, and he's standing in front of two TV sets, and you take your iPhone or whatever and stick it over the picture, and now the TV sets are on, and they're showing video. I thought that was cool.
That's amazing. But a friend of mine does live sports VR, and the opportunity is, you know, Manchester United as a club, you know, the biggest football club in the world.
Soccer to those
soccer,
of us here.
Soccer yes. for, exactly. So they can fit about 50,000 people in their stadium. They have about 100 million fans around the world, right? They're willing to pay good money for being closer to their club. That's the opportunity, right? And if you control the hardware and you can do deals like that, so Apple and Google can be those companies, you're talking big money.
Okay, so what's next, Mike?
Well, travel's in there. We talked to consumers about their topics.
Sony's got the next console.
So Sony's come out with the PlayStation VR last week. Mm-hmm. Oculus Lens is further down the road, which is rumored to be from Microsoft.
Google Daydream is a new device, a new headset coming
just
out
announced.
In November. It's coming out in November.
Oculus will be coming out and probably sell 500,000 units is my guess. Mm-hmm. Very interesting to see what we'll see with Samsung. It's probably a temporary setback for Samsung in terms of their brand, but they were going to drive, I think, a lot of device sales.
With the Samsung Gear.
Yeah.
For $100.
Yeah. But these are going to be, it's probably not even next Christmas. It's probably the Christmas after that where we start to see millions of units being sold, and they're probably in the 199 range.
Okay, well, this is a great segue for me because I was going to say, some of us get excited about the fourth quarter holiday shopping season to see what's the latest and greatest. Jim Armstrong is already thinking about Christmas 2017, right?
Right.
In 2018. In 2019, he's the managing director at March Capital Partners, which invests in tech companies. The March website says the company invests in breakthrough tech companies. So, Jim, what's the next big breakthrough?
Well, I'll relate it to retail. Thanks. thanks for that intro. We are investing in a variety of companies. So a thing a venture capitalist, I think, has to learn to do well is to not just focus on innovation, but try to understand when markets are going to happen, right? So if you looked at, if I talk about offline retail right now, which is still 90% of plus of purchases, and I'll break that into restaurant retail and product retail, if you like. Product retail is going to have its Y2K moment every year, the next 10 to 15 years. And any discussion around anything that's innovative in retail, whether that's customer acquisition driven, customer experience driven, customer connection driven post-sale, anything like that is a CEO level discussion at those companies. And so what am I saying? I'm saying that startups that are funded and focused there grow very, very quickly if they can come up with the right feature set, right? And many of the same things are true for restaurant retail. So that's one area we're really focused on. And then I'll give you one other because I could prattle on. But the other one I think is really interesting is this emergence of data. In the earliest forms of the web, we had a lot of lead gen. We had a lot of informational sites that dumped you off into a lead form or dumped you off into to your own experience. But when you consider a non-impulse purchase, a considered purchase, for consumers, that's a home, that's a car, that's a vacation. These are things you drip over time with data to make a decision. And even though a lot of the existing systems were set up to close you now, that's why buying a car is so awful, is they want to close you in 30 minutes and you want 30 days. And
they'll keep you there for 8 hours.
And they'll try to, but that's the orders they're under. But with all the innovation we're using and technology and mobile devices and persistence of data and following people, you can now match those. And any B2B purchase is not an impulse purchase. You don't just go out and buy a bunch of furniture for 30 offices. Everything is around a request for purchase, an RFQ, an RFP, a purchase order. And all these decisions really are in the very early stages of illuminating the data to the buyer over time and winning the market with that. And that's not just about a Google SEO win and getting traffic. That's about closing the purchase and representing to your buyer, be they a consumer or another business, that you're intelligent, you understand their needs, you understand the data of the market. We're not far from TrueCar's headquarters. I think they did a really good job in the automotive market. And I'm not an investor there, although I know the founders there. But one of the great things they did that was just a moment that really captures what we're trying to do at March is they changed the messaging from find the best deal to don't get ripped off. So we aren't a deal house anymore. We're just a data house because they realize that people really get anxiety about, did I get taken when they buy a car? They're willing to pay a fair price. And that's an insight, but it's a data-driven insight. And so we're seeing that across multiple verticals. We call that the B2B marketplace business or the big considered purchase marketplace business. And SaaS is a part of that and mobile is a part of that.
Sales, that's the software as a service.
That's something where those are two areas we're really excited about. So there are a lot of investments we do that are cutting edge and innovative, and we work with tech transfer, but we also, as I think a lot of venture investors do, try to focus on the markets that are about to happen now. I think engaging in when a market's going to happen, there's room for that for some of your investments, but only for some.
So what market's about to happen now?
I think the retail is happening now. I think the B2B markets were still
retail
very...
Retail being online? E-commerce?
Sorry. No, offline reacting to online. And by the way, online retail investing is very difficult right now.
Mean?
Sorry. Most of retail is offline still. And they have to react.
Like walking in the store
offline. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Sorry, I'm using my lexicon. And they can't just sit there and be picked off, right? Walmart's in trouble. Macy's is in trouble. Target is in trouble.
But you say this is a growing market.
I say that huge, huge market is ready to buy innovation from startups at a frenetic pace. You can grow a company to $100 million in revenue very quickly, a startup.
So what's the example? I think of Shopkick. Do you know Shopkick?
Yeah, I think Shopkick's a good example.
Okay, that's where they give you rewards when you walk in the door.
Yes.
And you've got an app. The app knows you walked in.
Yes.
And you start building bonus points.
Right.
You mean stuff like, this is what you're looking
for. I mean
at,
things
like
that. One, we're working with a couple companies that are working with, in offline retail, in walk-in retail, they have point-of-sale systems, which are not very agile. You cannot get information out of them. So we have some companies that are helping them get information out of them so they don't have to, so they know who every one of their customers is, not just the 5 or 6% that are in the loyalty program. And this will be a first for them. They only knew that store 1142 was up 10% over last year. They never really knew. Chipotle doesn't know how many customers it have, but we have some startups doing some incredible AI and machine learning that can tell them, here's the 46,342,000 customers who walked into all your stores last 12 months.
And how do we know?
They know by coalescing a lot of data sources, which is another big theme of a lot of the innovation here. But you actually can find that out to a very, very accurate level.
Every person goes in to Chipotle, we stay in line, we order our food, and then we pay.
Yeah, with a credit card.
So most people do with a credit card. Wouldn't that tell you if you had 3,000 transactions in a day that you had 3,000 people?
It would, but over the course of a year, how many are repeat customers?
Right.
And who are your growing customers? Who are your core customers? Who are your lapsing customers who used to come and don't come? And those customers over time, what did they buy? What SKUs and what's the most profitable?
And you've got apps that can figure that out.
We have some companies we've invested in. And I would break it into retailers that say, so if we stick with retailers, I mean offline, Home Depot, 15 years ago, this was their business. Get a corner lot, make sure there's parking, get a big orange sign, get a big box, and fill it up with things from China and replicate. And now if you go to Home Depot Ventures, which there is one, and they're very active, along with Lowe's Ventures, you know, in this market, everything's around how do I create a digital relationship with the customer? How do I give them a better experience in the store? And when they buy products, how do I stay in touch with them, right? So that's new,
right?
And that's wonderful. And I think those are very interesting markets. What's a tough market, I'll say, is e-commerce, because Amazon is so good at so many things. And I'm involved with on the board of some e-commerce companies, and you have to carve out a niche. Very similar to what Lipa was saying, instead of live, it's same-day delivery, right? Or it's gifting, or it's something that this incredible company called Amazon doesn't do. But I think e-commerce can be a really tough market right now, online, online e-commerce.
So, Jim, when you walk into a store in Manhattan Beach, mm-hmm. what goes through your mind? What are you thinking? Because you're not walking in just thinking, oh, I'm going to buy a piece of wood at the Home Depot. You've got all sorts of stuff going on. What are you thinking about?
Well, occupational hazard to me, I think, wow, what's this going to be like in 15 years? Are these just going to be showrooms? But honestly, I think about the experience, the tactile experience and the merchandising that's done and how there'll always be room for that in my life, right? But I'm 50, and it may not be that room for that in other people's lives. And over time, I found that in my family, Amazon Prime is just becoming, it's just getting more and more and more into my behavior patterns. It's what I think of first, whether it's through my Alexa, my Echo device, or I just ordered the Amazon Dash, which is the one I just got it.
You pick up on the
scan code.
Run out of Tide.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a generic one. It just can scan anything, or you can voice into it. It's a new device, but so that's getting ingrained in my behaviors. So I think I'd like to think there'll always be room for that retail, but we'll see.
I think there will be some, right? I just bought some memory cards today, but I bought them on Amazon. Could have run out to Best Buy, but I'm always going to buy food, I think, at the supermarket.
You buy
all your food somewhere else?
I'm using Amazon Fresh more and more, and I know you were interested in some of the things that Alibaba's doing in China and elsewhere. And I'll make a quick comment, then I want to hear what others have to say, but I think there's a big fight going on between the Instacarts and the people that are saying these goods and services are already distributed, they already have refrigeration, they've already been transported and stocked in stores. I just want someone to take them the last 500 yards. And Amazon just opened a 100,000 square foot facility, I think it is, in Boston to launch Amazon Fresh. Amazon says, we're going to bypass that channel. We're going to duplicate that channel. I think that's really interesting. But groceries especially, I do not enjoy the merchandising thereof. And I think for me personally, that's something that as soon as I can, I'll be going back to the days of Webvan and Home Grocer as I age myself. But I remember when those went out of business 15 years ago, I think my wife wept because we loved that service.
How's Lipa feel?
I haven't been in a supermarket in 2 years. I can't stand the experience. You know, I can never find what I need and what I want. I have everything delivered, groceries included. And Amazon Fresh is great.
Yes.
So you get all your food from Amazon Fresh?
All my food. What I do is I go for the experience when I retail, right? So I go to the market when I want to have a good experience. Or, you know, I go into a store just to get a little bit of extra that you can't get from an online experience when you want to enjoy and browse. I love bookstores, right? Just to discover. But otherwise, everything that's a commodity, everything that's a repeat purchase, oh, definitely online.
So give me an example of what kind of food you will buy every week. Do you get milk and eggs and apples and oranges and
everything? So, you know, first of all, my wife is a little bit more in charge here than I am. But one of the big benefits, and I'm a very lazy person, is the convenience of it remembers what you bought before. And Amazon is so smart. It says, oh, you buy this a lot. Why don't you subscribe? So you don't have to think about it anymore, right? So it takes away all that, you know, that worry and running out of stuff. And it's just a convenience. And Bezos has been very smart at figuring that out. So we buy steaks. We buy fish. By the way, I live in Santa Monica. The fish comes from Santa Monica Seafood Market, right? So the suppliers are very high end. It's just the delivery that they've made very easy. So,
and do you pay more for the food?
No, it's the same.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they the same as Ralph's?
Yeah, it's all in. I'm a Prime member, so it's all included. Okay, I sound like an ad now for Amazon.
What about Mike?
You do.
I think Santa Monica Food Company is very happy right now. That's a well-known brand here in the west side of L.A. It's great fish.
Absolutely.
Is Mike buying his food online?
I don't buy anything fresh online, but I buy almost everything else. I bought a tube of cortisone today for $6.10, and it will be there tomorrow. I think we're all upset about the amount of packaging.
Yeah.
That's a real problem that I'm sure is going to be solved. Have you heard of, Jim, have you heard of Boxed? They've been making kind of some excitement in doing non-fresh, large quantity for kind of mid-size stores. So they're taking a niche of kind of above where Amazon usually is, but non-perishables. They've raised a lot of money from guys like GGV and allegedly the A guys in China.
Yeah.
The A-L-I-B.
You guys have any tips for people who haven't done what you guys are doing and are listening right now and say, gosh, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to order this week's food on Amazon. Where do they start?
Go to your Amazon account and click on Amazon Fresh, and that's it. It's pretty straightforward.
I would say try it.
Do you guys make a list? Do you go milk, eggs, apples, oranges? I mean,
they do it for you.
They do it for you. They say, what do you need?
You type it in the search bar, you know?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, I do think it gets better over time. The thing I have enjoyed is I think we have 4 or 5 Amazon Echoes in our home. And we've tried to do some automation because Wi-Fi took the very, very expensive in-house home audio system down to hundreds of dollars with Sonos and some other things. And Amazon and Sonos don't work together yet because they're in a fight. They don't want to integrate because they each want to be the sound system. However, Amazon does work with Wemo, does work with Philips Hue, does work with Ring, does work with a lot of devices. And it's so easy to get these devices working over Wi-Fi now, whether it's lighting or sound or whatever. But also, one of the features that's fun is just to, and there's a lot of Amazon devices that do this now, and they have their own list, is start to create a list and see what happens. We do it just verbally, make a note we need this, or make a note we need that, or scan this, and then your list is there. But my advice is try it, and it gets better over time because of what Lipa said, is the list.
Okay, and Alexa understands you?
Alexa understands me better than Siri.
Well, that's not hard.
Fair enough.
Who's tried the Google Assistant? Anybody?
Not me.
That came out this week. I was playing with the Pixel phone, and the Assistant is like so much better than Siri. But
really?
That's a whole other story. Why is Siri so bad 5 years later? It's been 5 years.
Yeah.
It's been longer. Well, because it came out of Stanford Research Institute 15 years ago.
But it was introduced on the iPhone 4S 5 years ago, and it hasn't gotten much better.
Yeah, I don't know. I know Microsoft had the announcement this week about, it was very vague. It's just, we've come up with a new neural network. This is amazing breakthrough, but it wasn't specific on technology about their new, language. But I don't know. I assume it's something in the architecture they started with.
Okay.
That's just
well,
has to be
my cool
assumption.
Well, the cool thing is we're recording the show on Thursday, and we all know that Jim is going to go home tonight and really spend some quality time with his five Alexas.
That's right. Exactly.
He's going to talk to all of them.
You should at least change their names.
Yeah. No, I don't. They're number one, two, three, four, and five. But my children use them for music all the time because they're on Spotify, and they just say play whatever. And if you have school-age kids, they say, Alexa, wake me up at 6:30. And so the alarms are set. And so we use it for a lot of little
and
things like that.
And 64 divided by 7 equals.
Exactly.
That's how I do my homework.
And the population of Zimbabwe is. And again, all knowledge at your fingertips just means you can move up to higher knowledge. I think that's a good thing.
All right. Well, let's congratulate Jim on a wonderful evening that he's going to have tonight.
Yeah, I look forward to it now. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming in. And let's remind everybody how to find you in the online world. We can start with busker.co.
That's right. Very easy.
And Lippa, if they want to send you a tweet, how do they do that?
Twitter handle is at Lippa, LIPPE. So it's easy enough.
All right. Mike, where can they read
it? I am everywhere at Mike Vorhaus, V as in Victory, O-R-H-A-U-S. Mike Vorhaus, no dots, no spaces, no underlines. Right. Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn.
All righty. And Jim?
Yeah, LinkedIn's my preferred. If you just go Jim Armstrong at March Capital on LinkedIn, that's the best way to message me.
All right. I'm at Jefferson Graham on Twitter, Jefferson Graham on Facebook. I've got a website, jeffersongraham.net. Look for me at USA Today, tech.usaday.com. Thank you for listening to Talking Tech, and we'll see you on the next show.